Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today, and it's Garden Guy time for September. I'm your host, Tom Mazure, with Sue Mazure, and we get to grill poor Gary Heilig there. So welcome, Gary.
Hey.
I assume that you have some quiz questions and, of course, important information that's seasonal for each month.
I believe I do.
You blew. All right. Hey, Sue, will you, I guess I'm going to lead. Sue will lead the prayer.
Oh, okay. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to learn new things about what you've created and how it tells us about you, and that Gary will help us learn so we will grow closer to you and look forward to your coming the sooner. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. I should announce that Sue is joining us from the greater Kalamazoo area. And Gary is here in person. You've been absent for a couple months, and it's always best to have you here in person.
Well, my phone is not acting right, so. And okay. Plus, gas prices are down a little bit.
Yes. Well, we're glad about that. Well, not about your phone, but about the gas prices. So.
Oh, I don't have any problem with the phone being on out of whack.
That's why I usually call the house there.
Yeah.
Hey, give us the quiz. What you didn't even give us a hint. You didn't even give us a chance to do any back study. So we're going cold and blind today.
I think you'll get the first one. We're going to be talking about roses.
And okay.
It's my favorite flower. But the first question is fairly easy. Did rose plants have thorns in the Garden of Eden?
Now,
I say no.
I would say no. That just doesn't seem right.
That's right, because in Genesis 3:18, originally they didn't, because in Genesis 3:18 it says, "Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat of the herb of the field." And this is after sin came into the world. So you can assume that before sin, thorns and thistles weren't there.
So it's Genesis 18?
Genesis 3:18.
3:18. Okay, I'm going to need that for a future reference. Okay.
Okay, the next one is, where is the oldest known living rose?
Okay, Sue, this is your chance to shine.
I think I heard that it was somewhere in Europe, like Germany.
Ooh, good job. Yeah, it's over 1,000 years old, and Ooh. It grows on a wall of a cathedral of Hildesheim, and it's in Germany, and its presence has been documented since 815 A.D.
That is serious.
That's a long time to have a rose in one place.
I don't think we have any roses around our house that old.
Well, in Michigan,
I suspect it's not a modern tea rose either.
No, it's not, but we won't even come close to that in Michigan. All right, so the next one is, when were roses first cultivated?
Well, it must be more than 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
It was a biblical, it was mentioned in the Bible, so that helps, gives us some dating.
Sue?
It
is thousands of years.
I'm just thinking that it's either a race between, you know, like the Fertile Crescent thing or China.
Well, it's most likely China. They believe they've been around for at least 5,000 years. And Confucius wrote about growing roses in the imperial gardens at about 500 BC. And they had a number of books in the emperor's library that were specific topic to roses. So they've been around for at least 5,000 years. Now, here's the next question. Go ahead.
That's a long time.
Yeah. What was the first culture to cultivate roses? And we kind of talked about that already. That
kind of sounds like China.
I was gonna say it sounds like
Can I answer that one?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, China, but also they believe that the Sumerians were cultivating roses about the same time. Okay, this one might be easier or not so easy. What is the oldest color of rose that we know about?
I would say red.
I say pink.
Get out of town, Sue.
The wild roses that the wild dog roses that are like growing in places where people don't want them and stuff, they're always pink.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't those the sort of the original thing that started it all? And they're always pink.
Yeah, the majority of the roses, in terms of the first color that was cultivated, were indeed pink. Those were the most common ones in the wild. But, of course, horticulturists have selected for certain other colors, and now we have a wide variety of colors. But pink is the most common one found.
So name some of those colors. Maybe I don't have a...
Well, they can be red, and they claim that they have a black rose, but what it really is a very, very dark red. They just keep crossing the darkest reds, and to where they look a little black in areas, but they're basically dark red. They can be yellow to almost orange color. Sometimes they'll say they're like an apricot yellow, which is more toward the orange. Of course, they can be white, and they can be bicolor. And some people might have even come across something called a rainbow rose online, and it's multiple colors, but that's not a natural rose. It's a painted rose.
Oh. Is there anything such as a green rose?
There are some cultivars, but they're very lightish green. They're not real strong.
More of a lime.
Yeah. Light lime. Well, a very light lime, yeah. There are some
like that. I saw those in a catalog, and I thought, you got all the green leaves of all colors around here. Why would you want a green flower?
People like green. And I like green, too, but... When you have a green flower and the green tissue, like leaves and stems, there's no contrast there, and it's just not as attractive as when you have the contrast. But if you like a green one, who am I to judge?
That's right.
Well, my most important thing, I mean, I like some of the different colors. I'm fond of certain different colors, some of the bicolors and stuff too. But more importantly to me, when I was reading one of those rose catalogs, because they kept saying that very little or no fragrance. I'm like, why are you growing this? If I'm bothering to do the work for this, I want fragrance.
Well, have you heard of the word segue before?
Okay.
Well,
I think we were set up.
Yeah, it's great because we're going to move into, if you wanted to grow some roses that have fragrance, that's what we're going to talk about right now. And there are different types of roses like hybrid teas, which are the long stem cut roses that most people like. And usually when somebody gets a bouquet of roses, the first thing they do is smell them.
Right.
Not all roses have much of a scent to them. And so we're going to talk about the ones that do. For instance, in the hybrid teas, there is a bicolor called Double Delight, which has an absolutely wonderful smell. And this one is kind of a whitish rose with some yellow in the interior of it, and the outer petals have red. And it's quite an attractive rose. Won an All-America Rose Selection a number of years ago, and that one has an excellent scent. Then a red one is Mr. Lincoln. It's been around for quite a while, too, and I think that's an All-America Rose Selection also. Then there's another one called Memorial Day, and this is a pink hybrid tea. And another one you might want to try is called Secret, which is white with some pink. And then there's a final one in the hybrid tea, Royal Highness, which is also pink. So those are all known for very strong scents. Now, in the floribundas, which means it has multiple smaller flowers in a cluster, Sun Sprite is a yellow that has a really nice smell to it. And then, of course, by the name, this one should give it away. It's called Honey Perfume. And this is kind of an apricot to yellow color. And then we have another group called Grand Floras, which means they're like the Floribundas, only the flowers are larger, but they also grow in clusters. And there's one called Fragrant Plum that you might want to try. And that one's more of a dark pink. And then there are, for instance, Old English Roses. And there are a lot more stronger scents out there than what I have time to talk about, because there's quite a bit, and you can Google them or use some other search engine to find other names. But there's one called Heritage, which is an Old English type, and it's white with a light pink blush. And then there is a bourbon called Louise Odier, and this is a pink one, and Odier is O-D-I-E-R. So these are all examples of very fragrant roses. But one other thing that you can look for, especially if you are using a catalog that specializes in roses, a general indication that you may have a better chance of a good smell is darker colors tend to have nicer smells, and roses with very high petal counts. And in some books, they'll tell you the petal count is 25 to 30 or something like that. That just tells you how many petals there are on an individual flower. And a higher petal count usually means you'll have better fragrance. That's not always the case, but that's something that you can look at. So, as I said, you can go online and search different roses out. And when you take a bouquet like that, and you bring it in the house, and they're all fragrant roses, they'll just fill the room with a wonderful smell. And then, of course, maybe one day we can talk about all the things you can make from fragrant roses, like oils and lotions and things like that.
You can bake with them, too, I understand.
Yeah, and rose water is used in Middle Eastern. There's like rose candies, and there's rose water is used as a flavoring. So there are lots of things that you can do, assuming that you're not spraying your roses with lots of chemicals.
So should you avoid having, if you're trying out perfumes or colognes, you can get a sensory overload. Is there any reason that you want to separate your roses, if they were very fragrant, to avoid clashing or...
You mean with other flowers?
With other roses, even. I mean, if it's a different variety.
No, that usually won't be a problem. I mean, you could, if you wanted, just grow a particular thing like Double Delight, or you can mix them together. Now, there are some different descriptions
clash to
their scents, but I've never smelled a group of roses where if I brought them in, it would clash.
Okay.
But the smells or the fragrances can be subtle, but they still smell like roses. Some may have a slight hint of citrus to them. Some are described as a little bit more spicy, but they're not so different that I think they would clash.
And we may have talked about in the past about the rose market. I understand that, is it the Dutch that are very big in roses? That's many of them fly from all over the world.
Well, a lot of them are grown now in South America, and they ship them up. But many of those roses, they're not grown for fragrance. They're grown for their long stems. They're grown for the colors. They're grown because they last longer. They're interested in something different than, say, a person at a home rose garden would. So most people like the scent, and that's not a high priority with the florist industry.
I haven't noticed any florist roses that had much of a scent at all, which I find a bit disappointing.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. You see these beautiful roses, and your first thought is to smell them, and then you come away with nothing, absolutely nothing. But if somebody has ever had a chance to cut a bouquet from a garden of fragrant roses and just smell that, aromatherapy is a really big thing in our society right now, and it has a calming effect. It can affect your overall attitude. And you've heard the phrase, take time and smell the roses.
Right.
It's worth it. It really is. We're so busy nowadays, and we're doing all these things, and there's so much stuff in nature that's there for our pleasure.
What if you don't have roses that are fragrant in your garden? Where's the nearest place to get that wonderful scent?
Let's not do that, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Rip out those ones that you don't particularly care for and put some new fragrant ones in there. Or just make your bed bigger.
Well, I was just thinking, for instance, are there any floral gardens that some of our listeners may want to visit to find these fragrant roses?
Well, there's some at Michigan State University's Rose Garden. They have a rose garden there. Most likely, if you go to Dow Gardens, they'll have some there. Meyer Garden in Grand Rapids, I would be surprised. I don't know this for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if they have some roses there. So another thing you could do is just jump online again. That's one of the great things about the internet is you can type in like Rose Gardens in Michigan and or Rose Gardens in the Midwest, and you'll find out where they all are.
If you don't mind traveling a bit, some years ago, a friend and I, we went camping for a week out east, and we went to Hershey, Pennsylvania, which everybody thinks of as the chocolate capital, which it is. And we took the chocolate tour and so on. They got a lot of other attractions there. And one of them, which we did not know till we went there, is they have a very large botanical gardens, Hershey's Gardens there, kind of up on the hill above the town and so on. And we picked that to go to. And they have a huge different, you know, they have like a Japanese garden and a butterfly garden. They're very large, lots of things. But they have a very large rose garden. And we went in July or August, and they're like, oh, too bad you didn't come sooner. They've already peaked. Sure didn't look that way to us. There was plenty of roses in there. And we even saw, because they had a lot of heritage roses that you can hardly find anywhere else. And Tom, to my astonishment and pleasure, they had that rose that you bought for Mother in Lansing and planted there, the Crimson Glory. I've not seen it since you bought that for her when we were kids and we moved away, and I've never seen it again. But they had a cultivar of Crimson Glory there. They had Cardinal Richelieu, those purple roses, and they had all kinds of stuff there. And so if you're traveling out there, it's worth a visit.
And if you wanted to find Crimson Glory, you could just type in a search engine, where can I buy Crimson Glory roses? And most likely it's going to come up.
Very good.
It probably will. Not that I have anywhere to plant them, but I just was really impressed by how many, many, many roses that they had there.
Well, we've had a good discussion about roses, and in our next segment on Good Growing with the Garden Guy, September edition, we're going to talk about Turf Improvement Month. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, surely I am coming quickly. We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
3, 2, 1. Well, welcome back, folks, to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, September edition. We talked about roses in the first segments. If you missed that, you will want to go to our archive page. The easiest way to get there is str.fm, str.fm, and look under Resources, Archives, and Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Thanks so much for joining us. We have my co-host, Sue Majeure from Kalamazoo.
Howdy.
And Gary Heilig, retired from Michigan State Extension Service and still teaching some classes. He is our garden guy. Well, Gary, I'm glad to have you back, and it's September is Turf Improvement Month, probably because we're supposed to be doing something for next season.
Well, it depends on how much you care about your turf.
Okay.
Some people really like those beautiful lawns with nothing but the grass species that they wanted. And others, like myself, I have what I call a diverse community of plants.
Okay.
I like the idea of having that perfectly nice Kentucky bluegrass lawn. It looks so nice. If you go to the MSU and you walk around at the turf Hancock Center, the Hancock Turf Center, and look at all the different grasses out there, they're beautiful. But it's not natural in nature. And in order for us to have something like that, there are a lot of inputs that have to be put in. For instance, most people don't think about mowing, and we've talked about this in the past, but if you are still mowing your lawn short, like my neighbor, and I'm talking about 1 to 2 inches, you actually encourage weeds to come into your lawn. Because when the grass is taller, it shades the surface, which a lot of weed seeds need light in order to germinate. But also, when you have a larger blade or a longer blade, then it allows the plants to get thicker and fill in and basically crowd out the space for the weeds to grow. If there's open space in your lawn, guaranteed nature's going to say, oh, there's a good place. I'll put some seeds over there.
Wow.
They may not be the ones that you want, though.
Right.
So there's some things you need to do. And one of the things we tell people is you should have your mower up to about 3 inches
okay. In
height and just leave it there all the time. And another thing that helps is if you do have some grubs in your lawn, which the new grubs came out in July, when you have a thicker, taller lawn, it takes more grubs before you even know they're there. So, for instance, if you were digging around and you were talking before we started again, you were finding like 3 grubs here, 3 grubs there. On a well-maintained lawn, you wouldn't have to be concerned about it at all, which decreases the need or eliminates the need for any kind of grub control. Or if, say, for instance, you went out in a lawn that was not very well maintained and you dug down and you saw like 15 grubs per square foot, well, that's going to kill your lawn if you don't do something about it.
Yeah. Hey, well, you know, I was visiting my son in the suburbs of Detroit, and I was thinking about this. I was noticing some white splotches as you go from subdivision lot to subdivision lot. Mm-hmm. Some of them were more pronounced and some were more diminutive. What you can tell by looking at surveying a variety of lawns, and what does it tell you by just a visual?
Oh, a lawn can tell you a lot. For instance, there are a number of lawn diseases that lawns can get. For instance, if somebody is in a subdivision, the lawn was put down as a sod and the topsoil was gone because when they built the subdivision, they sold off the topsoil. I pretty much guarantee that within a couple of years, you're going to get something called necrotic ring spot. It used to be called fusarium, but we won't get into that story because they found out that it was other types of funguses. But based on how well the lawn was established and what kind of soil it's on and various other environmental conditions, I can pretty much tell you what types of diseases are like to happen there. Some need to be treated, but the majority of lawn diseases don't have to be treated because if the weather just changes, then you don't have the problem. For instance, rust will start to show up in September because we start to have more heavy dews in the morning. The grass is wet at night. And so you walk across there and your tennis shoes turn yellowish to orange. Well, that's a rust disease. But as soon as the weather changes again or it gets drier, that rust will go away. So I usually would tell people, just keep mowing it and taking care of it like you normally do. And the turf can handle that. So most of the time, if you're just doing the cultural things right, like mowing properly, getting water on at the proper time, not watering late in the evening so that things stay wet for long periods of time, fertilizing properly, putting on the right amount of nitrogen at the right time of the year, and most of these things don't require treatment. Plus, the fungicides for turf are pretty expensive, so you'd rather not have to do that.
Let me ask you, I noticed something just last night. This was out in the country on a large lawn. The lawn looked very nicely green, but there was a circle that was, 6 to 8 feet in diameter, and it was very green, pronouncedly more deeper green. What would be the root cause of that?
We call that a fairy ring.
Ah, yes.
And a lot of times they'll be associated with mushrooms, too, in that ring. And for the most part, they're more of a nuisance than anything. They start fairly small, and then they just keep spreading and spreading and spreading until they go away. And the best way to deal with something like that, if it drives you nuts, which somebody that likes that Scott's lawn type of thing, it would bother them. You just put some extra nitrogen down in that area and green up the rest of the lawn. And you can also use a little bit of iron because iron will green up your lawn too. And
does that just hide it?
It just disguises it, yeah, because it'll go away. So a lot of times you have mushrooms that are associated with decaying organic matter. Mm-hmm. And they show up after you've had a lot of rain. So we haven't seen much of that this year because it's been very dry. But it's nothing to worry about. They'll come and go. I don't even get excited about them.
You know, going back, you were mentioning a turf center at Michigan State University. My gut reaction was it's kind of like a new car showroom. Is I shouldn't go there because I don't want to buy it. So
no, what they do is research on turf grasses.
Okay.
So if you go over there, especially when they're having their open house during the summer, it's usually around June or July. And at that time, they mark off all the different grasses. So you'll see maybe 30 different Kentucky bluegrass species or variety, not species. You'll see turf-type tall fescues, perennial rye, bent grass lawns. And they will tell you different research. They might be evaluating a new cultivar. They might be looking at how certain cultivars stand up against diseases that affect that particular species. They do all kinds of research, and then they just do reports. And it's worth it even for a homeowner to go over there every once in a while and find out what they're doing, because most people would not think that you'd have a whole farm that's dedicated to turf research. But when you think about how important turf is in the landscaping industry and the golf industry and recreation and various other things, sports, it's a pretty big deal.
So
do they have any I saw some program where they were researching the turfs, but they also had like these little ground covers that you didn't have to mow. They were only like an inch or so high, and that was your lawn. And they were doing research on that. Does it have that sort of thing too?
They don't do as much work on ground covers, but there are some grasses that have been developed that require less nitrogen and require less water. And some species of grasses will grow more slowly. And for instance, there's an orchard grass, which normally they don't deal with orchard grasses, but I know of an orchard grass that you put down for covering your orchard that it doesn't require mowing like it would if it was just the lawn grass. You might only mow it once or twice a year. So, yeah.
That's my type of grass.
Yeah, but that's not really a turf lawn type grass. It's more for like agricultural uses. But for somebody that is looking for less work, certainly one of the things that would cut down your work, unless you have an automatic irrigation system, is a turf grass that doesn't need very much water, or one that requires less fertilizer, which in the long run will cost you less money.
Now, this is more towards the garden side, but it's still talking about grass. We have a grass in our garden that invades it. It can be very, very huge. It's wide. It's not necessarily super. It's tall, but not. It's as wide as it is tall. And somebody called it Johnson grass. Is that kind of a colloquialism, or is?
No, there's all kinds of grasses that are not used for turf grass. For instance, there's, as you said, the Johnson grass. There's quack grass. There's orchard grass. There are a number of different grasses. Some of them are native, and some of them were brought from Europe, when either by accident or on purpose. It depends on what grass we're talking about. But if they get into a garden where the garden is well watered and the soil is loose and well fertilized, then they're gonna get big.
Yeah, this is a very fast growing, and it's tough. You almost, without specialized shovels, you almost cannot slice through the root system.
Well, actually, you don't have to slice through the root system. In situations like that, I would just cover up that area and with the, we've talked about this before, with a 4-mil black plastic, and no plant can survive lack of sunlight.
What it does is it's right on the fence row. I've got it for the deer fence, and mm-hmm. it just thrives in that no man's land between the weed cover on the outside. And
well, what you could do is cover up that area outside the garden, kill that out, and then re-sow a different grass in there. And once you get a good grass community growing, then it makes it more difficult for other grasses to come in. So let's use quack grass as an example. Mm-hmm. That's a grass that moves by rhizome, and those rhizomes can go 20, 30 feet or more.
Those are a little under the surface,
yeah.
A little.
Uh-huh. And but you'll notice that quack grass will move into a thin lawn quite effectively. But if you have a nice, thick turf, it's not as successful in moving into the lawn. So if you can get another grass growing around the edge of your garden after you've killed out the Johnson grass, and it can be killed chemically, but most people don't want to use things like Roundup or whatever. But if you smother it out and then reseed another grass in there, you'll have less trouble with it in the future.
Now, I have a fellow farmer, amateur farmer, semi-pro, if you wish. They took the thick agricultural ground cover, laid it down, and then drove their fence posts in, so it was underneath the fence,
mm-hmm.
and so it gave it less access.
Now, when you say ground cover, are you talking about like landscape fabric or something?
It's a very thick. It's heavier than what you can buy at any of the garden
yeah,
centers.
You could use a barrier too. But it would have to be deep enough so that roots wouldn't go under it.
I've noticed that. Good point. I have some weeds that are starting to penetrate into that ground cloth. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they can, like, for instance, some of the thicker landscape fabrics that you can buy from Home Depot, grasses can grow up through them, especially if they have any tear or anything like that in them. But one way that you can improve your success would be, for instance, I bought a roll of this stuff from Home Depot, and it's about 6 feet wide. If you wanted it thicker, just fold it so that you have it 2 feet high, but it's three layers thick, and that'll make it almost impossible for the grass to grow through it.
Well, I find that in my situation, it's not growing up through it. It's actually growing down. The roots are actually penetrating through and binding itself to the
Landscape fabric.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not going to get through it if it's like three thick. So you have a much less chance of it getting through. But that's why I said if you smother out something, you don't have to worry about it spreading because it's dead. Then all you have to do is put something there so that any seeds that are in the soil will have difficulty growing up through the new grass that you've established.
Did we talk about grub control?
No, I just wanted to let people know that as you get into September, the grubs are more mature, so a lot of the chemicals that worked earlier, especially if it's imidacloprid, which has a different, what we call, mode of action than some of the other chemicals, it's a hormone disruptor as opposed to a contact insecticide where you come into contact with it, it kills you. You have to move more toward the contact insecticides as you get into September and October. Most people usually do their grub control in September if they need it. But you have to go to something like 7 or Dilox at that point. And the 7 is in a granular form. It's not the dust that you would put on other vegetables.
Talking about things in the lawn, I'm going back to that same suburban Detroit lawn. I noticed that most of these white spots, they're closer to the road. Is there a reason why they are tend to be curbside rather than back in the main part of the lawn?
Well, it depends on what time of the year you're seeing this.
This is currently.
Okay. A lot of times when you get close to the curb, those areas aren't well maintained, so the grass will get more stressed. And just like you and I, if we get too stressed and there's a bug in the neighborhood, we can get sick. Well, if you have the right conditions and the grass is stressed, then you can start getting a disease. Now, it's hard to tell a disease by just looking at it. There are some that you can identify because there are things to look for, but some grass problems, you get to them when everything's just dead. Mm-hmm. So what I normally tell people when they're trying to diagnose what the problem is if they're not sure, they can cut out a section of that lawn, usually about 1 square foot,
sure.
Half of it in the healthy area, half of it in the dead area. And if there is a disease active, it's going to be active at that transition zone. And you can take it to your local extension office, and they would normally send it up to MSU, and there's a charge for it. But then they would try to culture out what the pathogen was.
Wow.
But if you've been at it for a while, and they're good in giving information as to when it showed up and the progression of the disease, and they give some good pictures of it, then a lot of times a horticulturist can figure it out if they have any experience in turf.
Well, we've completed the second segment of Good Growing with the Garden Guy September edition. We'll be back after this break.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, with Gary Heilig and Sue Majeur and yours truly, Tom. Hey, Gary, you've got a story to tell.
Are we talking about the grapes?
That's right, grape stories.
Well, it's more than just grapes. You know, I was out looking at some grapes in my garden, and I had some really nice clusters out there, and I said, oh, wow, there's going to be some good grapes this year. And came out about a week later to see how they were doing, and they were gone. Mm-hmm. Every last one. And I suspect it's the same creature that took all of my apricots this spring. I had picked one or two apricots to see if they were ready, and they were about a day or two before they were ready. And I came out, and I said, I don't see any orange apricots on that tree. And I looked down at the base, and there was all these apricot pits.
Oh, no.
And as you well know, it was a rocky raccoon that went out there and took everything. So what I'm going to have to do, I don't want to hurt anybody. I've gotten a little soft in my old age. I think I've said this once before, but my father was from West Virginia. And he used to, we used to call him Mountain Man Hillbilly. And he used to hunt squirrels, try to get us to eat them, but we weren't having it. If it didn't come from A&P and Kroger's, we weren't doing it. So anyway, by the time he was in his 70s, and I'll be 69 in December, he was feeding squirrels.
So he went soft too.
Oh,
huh?
He went real soft. So I think it's genetic.
I see. <Yeah. laughs>
I don't want to hurt him, but I sure get mad at him. So next year they're going to meet around my apricot tree a complete cage.
Okay.
So I'm going to build a complete cage around the tree, top, sides, everything. And I'm going to invest in some, there are grape nets that you can buy, which you can put over your tree to not only protect it, or I mean the vines, to not only protect from something like raccoons, but also birds, because birds will pick your plants clean too. And the same thing happened to our blueberries.
Uh-huh.
So in one way, I said, well, I guess I don't have to process all that, but I didn't grow them for them to take everything.
That's right.
And that's an example of sin, Tom, selfishness.
There he goes. Was selfishness in your behalf or sin in the fact that the raccoons took your...
Yeah, I don't mind sharing. There's plenty to share. But when you take all of it, come on now.
So you're pretty certain that it's your friend Rocky Raccoon.
Oh, I have no doubt about it.
Well, I was going to say you might put a trail cam up there to verify that.
I do have some cameras that could do that, but I don't need to because they're on a night shift. Everything disappears at night.
Okay. Hey, listen, how's your citrus trees growing?
Well, my lemon tree has lemons on it now.
All right.
Now, it'll take a while for them to ripen because, say, for instance, if the citrus tree is blooming in Florida in the late winter, early spring, they won't harvest until almost a year later.
Really?
So it'll be a while. It'll be a while before I get anything.
Now, this is the one that you put out in the summer and you bring in and harvest?
Yeah, it's in a pot, and I roll it down. I have an underground garage that you can drive into in addition to a regular attached garage. So I just roll them down there, and I'm going to put lights in that room. I normally did in the basement, but those pots are heavy. So I'm just going to roll them down the underground garage and then open the door and heat that room when I need to.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I'm growing potatoes in 5-gallon pails, and I've been told about that. You can harvest all winter long and so on and so forth. But some of them were large pots that probably were used for large bushes or small trees. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine how heavy that is once I put the last level of dirt on the potatoes.
Yeah, they can be pretty heavy, but I move things. I have little carts with wheels on them, so I can just push everything around. Now, my other citrus tree was a tangelo tree, and the tangelo had some problems. It had a disease, and I'd gotten a letter from the company saying that the feds kind of got after them because they were shipping some diseased plants, and they promised to exchange it, but they never did.
Oh.
So I need to call them back. But it had died back. It was a 6-foot tree when I bought it, and I cut it back to about 3 feet. And it's doing well, but I lost a lot of growth. So it's not going to produce for a few years yet.
And
but they're doing fine.
And that one is also, you bring that in and out.
Yeah, you have to. Citrus will not take the temperatures we have in Michigan. They're considered semi-tropical plants. So you have to be like mid to southern Florida in order to grow them, or southern Texas.
So when you talk about temperatures, it makes me think about in my garden. I've been told that once you refrigerate a tomato, you put it out at room temperature, it will spoil quicker. I've been told that. I don't know if that's
Well, when you think about it, tomatoes are warm season crops. Most refrigerators are around 34 degrees. So that's not good for tomatoes. So it's probably true that they would break down faster, but it certainly will affect their flavor. So a tomato should be allowed to ripen at room temperature. The only reason I would put it in the refrigerator is if I could not consume the whole tomato that day. And if you put it in the refrigerator overnight, it's going to change it a little bit, but it will last a little bit longer than it would if it was sitting out at room temperature once it's cut.
So when the temperature, it's dropping into the 50s occasionally, low 50s.
That's not going to harm them at all.
That's not going to change things.
And they won't grow very fast, but it won't harm the fruit.
Okay. What, talk about preservation. Does a tomato last longer on the vine? Or if you pick it, does it slow down? Will it ripen at a slower rate once it's picked? The reason is I've got excess inventory. Sometimes the sales of my tomatoes may not be moving, and I'm waiting for a customer to materialize. I've got to hold it. Is it better to leave it on the vine and it will last longer, or will it last longer if I pick it?
Well, that depends on a number of things. The plant hormone that is most effective in getting things to ripen is ethylene.
Right.
So the more ethylene there is around, the faster that process is going to go. Also, temperature makes a difference. If you have it on the vine and it's starting to cool down, then the ripening process is going to slow down. Once you pick it, then the process is going to go on regardless because you're moving it into a warmer area. What is done commercially is tomatoes are picked when they're mature, but they're not ripe. And then they ship them because they're quite hard at that time. And then when they get them to, say, Myers or Kroger warehouses, they treat them with ethylene to finish that process up. The flavor is not as good as it would be if you left it on the vine, but it's still considered a ripe tomato. So if I could leave it on the vine, I would. And as I said, as you get further into the fall, they will slow down. But also when you leave them on the vine and they're subject to the weather that Michigan has in the fall, then you're more likely to get diseases like specifically late diseases like anthracnose, which will actually affect the fruit itself.
What does it look like when you have that?
You start to get these little round sunken circles on the fruit.
Okay, sure. Okay.
Yeah, and that's a real common thing. Now, the other two diseases like Septoria leaf spot and early blight, they affect the plant, which in defect inadvertently it affects the fruit, but not directly.
Yeah, when the plant dies, it's not good for the fruit.
Well, it'll still ripen even if the plant is dead once it goes beyond mature.
So after that little segue or that little rabbit trail, let's go get back to banana production. How's your banana project?
Well, this is a little experiment I'm doing. We've talked about the bananas that we eat here. It's called Cavendish. So I bought a dwarf Cavendish banana plant this year, and it's about 2 feet high. And what the plan is I will grow it outside until it gets too cool for it, which probably late September it'll start to come in. It'll be grown under lights for the winter months. And then next summer, I will plant it in the ground. Because once the plant produces your bananas, then it won't produce any more bananas on that herbaceous part of the plant. It can send up suckers and you can start the whole process over. But that part will be done. Hopefully, it'll be large enough and mature enough next year when I set it out, it'll produce bananas. And, of course, we'll talk about that next year.
Okay.
If it's not ready yet, if it doesn't grow enough and mature enough, then the second thing I'll do is I'll dig it out, put it in a pot again, and overwinter it, hoping that it won't start to produce bananas during the winter months because you want it to produce its fruit when the sun is given its full strength and it's outside. So my plan is to grow some bananas here in Michigan. I've never tried that before, and I'll let you know. And it'll probably be on YouTube too.
All right. And hey, why don't you give your YouTube channel address while we're talking about it?
You can just go to Gary Heilig on any search engine, YouTube, and it'll pop up. It's Heilig.
Very good. You've brought up the subject of pruning apples and pears.
Well, when you prune later in the season, like in August and September, you can actually slow down the growth next year because you're removing green tissue from the plant. But what I'm going to try this year in my orchard is to prune out all the suckers and water sprouts in the fall.
Okay.
And the suckers are growth that grow up from the rootstock, which you don't want. And the water sprouts are branches that grow straight up from the side branches, which are unproductive wood. I would normally have to take that out during the winter months. So what I'm going to try and do is take it out in September, October, November, and hopefully it won't be enough time for anything to grow back, and it'll shorten my pruning time for next year and also probably decrease the overall growth of the plants next year because of the material that I take out. So it's something you can do now. Now, I've also mentioned early in the season when suckers or water sprouts are new, the suckers you'll have to cut off, but the water sprouts, they'll be so green that you can just snap them off with your hand. But if you allow them to grow during the course of the season, then you'll have to cut them off. So at this point, I'll have to cut them off. But it might save me some time this winter. Now, I would not do that with cherries and apricots and peaches. They're a little bit more tender when you're pruning at the wrong time of the year. So I don't think I would push my luck on that.
Okay. What is it time to order for next season 2023 and why?
A lot of times people wait until the catalogs come in the mail before they start to order. But if you're ordering things like certain ornamental trees or you want to get fruits like strawberries or some of these things, and especially if you're going to some of the commercial companies, now's the time to put in the order because the best stuff goes out first. And you are more likely to get something that you want and you don't have to get substitutions if you order early. Now, you won't necessarily get any discounts this time of year. Most of the coupons come out when they send out their catalogs. Usually catalogs start showing up before Christmas, which I always wondered why they took them so long to figure that out. But it's a great Christmas gift to give people gift certificates and things. But now's the time to get those orders in. And that way you can be sure that you're getting what you want to get.
What about your seed crops, vegetables?
Vegetables, you can wait longer if you want. I would try to get the newer ones, though. If there's some new All-America selections coming out or some award-winning plant, then I would order those as soon as I could. But the general vegetables, usually if you're buying them locally, like at Lowe's or Menards or Home Depot or a place like that, they have discounts of about 25% usually in January or February. So if you want to wait, you can. But again, if you want to be sure that it's available, get it now. You never know.
What if you order from a seed house in quantities anyway, so you don't rely on the local retailer? When is the best time to order from?
From now until next growing season.
How do you know that you're getting the new season seeds versus a year ago seeds?
Every seed packet has stamped on it. It'll say packed for a certain season. So now there are certain seeds that do not last very long at all, like onions and corn. We've talked about this before, that they don't last long. Something like broccoli or anything in the cole crop family and a number of other things, seeds can be good for up to 6 years. So if they mix in some older seed, as long as it's still viable, it's not a problem. It's selling old seed that's a problem, that has a very short life in terms of longevity. So they'll tell you what it's packed for.
What is there time to grow your cold crop for a second season? Or is it past that?
If you have a greenhouse.
Okay.
If you have a greenhouse, yes, you could probably still get some dark leafy greens, which are very good for you, by the way. Now, I know yours isn't heated, and it's hard to predict what the weather's going to be like, but most likely you could at least get some smaller leaves. You're not going to get the full size that, say, collards normally would get, but when you pick them when they're smaller, they're more tender anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had put some seeds in now and you had, a warm fall, you could probably get some things. Now, if we end up having cold weather early, basically what will happen is those things will just sit there and be dormant until they get the temperatures that they need in order to grow.
Wow. We've completed another program of Good Growing with the Garden Guy, with Gary Heilig. Gary, would you give your YouTube address again?
You can either just contact or get to it by using my name, Gary Heilig, in the search engine box, H-E-I-L-I-G, or my channel name is Get Growing with Gary Heilig. You can type that in too.
Well, great. Well, for the people here at Strong Tower Radio, we want to wish you good growing this month, and we'll meet you again next month with Sue and Tom Mazur, and of course, Gary Heilig. Goodbye, folks.